This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Central Bangkok hit by deadly bomb blast. Drones could fight wildfires. Turning a page in a book gets a new meaning.
There's instructions printed on the pages that says water is unsafe to drink in your village, and if you want to protect your health, use this book as a water filter.
A new American film looks at the rise and fall of some gangster rap pioneers. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. More than 20 people have been killed and 120 wounded in an explosion Monday evening near a popular site in central Bangkok. The blast hit the commercial Ratcha Prasong intersection close to the open-air Erawan Hindu Shrine. The explosion targeted an area that draws tourists and shoppers with five-star hotels and upscale stores. Surveillance cameras caught the moment the bomb went off as cars and motorcycles were passing through the busy corner. International Edition's Victor Beatty spoke with correspondent Barry Newhouse in Bangkok about the police investigation, which has yet to have any claim of responsibility.
Police have come out with some information saying that essentially the tactics used in this attack and perhaps the bomb materials itself do not bear the hallmarks of the insurgents who carry out bomb strikes in Thailand's south and have done so for over the past decade. Beyond that, we don't really know much. The bomb itself appears to have been a pipe bomb that was left at the shrine. Police at one point said they thought it was from TNT, and they are looking for a woman who was seen at the site. But right now, there are no groups that have claimed responsibility for it. Political leaders from all sides of the spectrum in Thailand have come out to condemn the attack, and so I think we'll find out in the coming days sort of where this investigation is headed.
Well, Barry, Bangkok has been relatively free of terrorist attacks or any kind of attack, but it also has been a scene of political tensions. What's going on there?
That's right. Last year, we had a lot of political unrest. There were street protests that occasionally were violent with some sporadic attacks, nothing near the scope of this. But essentially, once the military came in and took over, it's been very quiet. And, you know, they've gotten a lot of criticism because they've essentially frozen the democratic process here and there's no election on the horizon. And the military at times has come out and said that they are staying in power because of various unspecified threats to the country, which outside analysts have been skeptical of. But essentially, the political process here is stalled. And so there obviously are opponents of the military government, But again, all of the factions that have had tensions with the military in the past, this would be a very odd incident if indeed they are behind it, because it doesn't bring the cause any further along to carry out an attack like this on such an important shrine in Bangkok. And I think that's important because the shrine itself is popular with both Thais and with tourists. This is really, in many ways, the kind of heart of downtown Bangkok. When you ride the sky trains around the city, many of them cross sort of in front of this shrine, and it's really striking because Thai people will actually bow to the shrine as you're going past it in the SkyTrain. And so it's a really revered place, a really special place in Bangkok. And for someone to carry out an attack like this, I think many people are just in shock.
Thailand is a real tourist attraction. What impact might this have on the tourist industry?
Well, the tourist industry has suffered in recent years, although with the military, with the political unrest and the military takeover. However, there has been a surge in visitors from China. Tourism makes up about 10% of Thailand's economy, and Chinese tourists in particular have been very important as tourists from Western nations have dropped off in the last couple of years. Chinese tourists have more than made up for it. And so the fact that this, the timing of the attack and the location of it and the fact that there are tourists among the dead, Thai authorities very clearly believe that this was an attack on the tourism industry and more broadly on the Thai economy.
Correspondent Barry Newhouse in Bangkok speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Another member of the VOA team in Bangkok, Steve Herman, was among the first reporters on the scene of Monday's attack. He's also been sharing what he found on social media. Michael Lippin is here to tell us more about that. Michael, what's Steve been reporting?
Hi, Ray. Well, I can tell you that Steve is quite a prolific reporter when it comes to Twitter. His handle is at W7VOA. He's got 38,000 followers, and he tweeted more than 40 times in the hours after the bombing. His first tweet about the incident came within a few minutes of the actual explosion. Responding to another Twitter user who reported hearing a blast, Herman wrote this: "I heard it clearly here in Chitlam. Odd, but I thought it was a one-off thunder boom, no?" Later, he actually went to the blast site and posted his observations from there and information updates from local media and Thai authorities. One of his most widely seen posts was actually on Periscope. It's a live video streaming service that's connected to Twitter. Herman and his videographer Zinlat Ong started a live Periscope broadcast from a mobile phone as they walked to the scene of the Erawan Shrine, and they soon encountered bodies lying on the street. Some of the images are quite graphic. You can also see some of their tense interactions with security officials at the site. If you missed the broadcast, you can find it online by going to Google and then doing a search for Steve Herman on Periscope. But just a warning, the video is pretty disturbing.
Michael, what are some of the hashtags people are using to talk about the attack?
Well, the most widely used hashtag by far is hashtag PrayForBangkok. The Topsy Analytics website shows that hashtag has been used 462,000 times in the past day. The second most widely used hashtag appears to be hashtag Bangkok, used in about 68,000 tweets in the same period. Well, the hashtag PrayForBangkok is particularly popular among Thai-speaking Twitter users and also by many other people around the world who have been sending the Thai capital messages of sympathy and support at this difficult time. Ray?
Thanks, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lippin. That's L-I-P-I-N. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition. The price of oil is trading near six-year lows, and market watchers are not predicting a rebound anytime soon. Alexis Christophorus, our business correspondent in New York, is following the trend and tells us what industry experts are saying about the reasons for the oil market slump.
Well, it was another tough day in the oil pits. Oil futures falling to $41.90 a barrel in the last session. Traders are continuing to focus on the global supply glut and production surplus. And in a weekly report, analysts at Morgan Stanley said they have concerns about crude fundamentals and prices in not only the second half of this year, but into next year. The bank is warning that oil demand is already near peak seasonal levels and will fall in the coming weeks as summer demand starts to wane. And the analysts believe there is still a lot of momentum behind this oil sell-off, and they remain bearish on oil prices for the time being. There's also concern surrounding the planned bankruptcy of U.S.-based Samson Resources. Analysts believe it may be the first of many oil and gas companies to declare bankruptcy, and that's a trend that could at some point hurt production. One move that may actually help support oil prices in the coming months is news that U.S. oil companies are expected to get approval to trade oil with Mexico. And this is seen as a milestone in loosening a four-decade ban on selling U.S. crude overseas, and it may prop up prices.
VOA business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. As the United States and Cuba begin a new chapter in diplomatic relations, the business community on Wall Street awaits Congress's next move, cautiously preparing for new opportunities in investment and commerce. Ross Kenneth Erkin is a personal finance editor for online American news site TheStreet.com. He tells VOA that investors are excited about the prospect of doing business with Cuba, but are also being realistic.
In terms of actually investing in individual American companies, Airbnb, Google, those executives have visited Cuba, Netflix. People are interested in figuring out a way to play up the modernization of Cuba. And Airbnb in particular has been the most successful thus far because of the Casa Particular, which is basically Cuba's bed and breakfast, rent out your apartment option. And it's popular across the island. Airbnb came in the spring and has over 2,000 possibilities the country over. So it's really tapped into a need for, there's a shortage of hotel rooms, a need for individual Cubans to make money, and that's allowing for a great transformation in the economy.
Erkin also says he's seen several examples of U.S. businesses being proactive about entering the Cuban market. That was Kenneth Erkin, personal finance editor of the Streetcom.com. More than 100 wildfires are burning across the American West, forcing hundreds of people to flee and destroying dozens of homes. Extreme heat, severe drought, and gusty winds are spreading the fires in the states of California, Oregon, and Washington. 14,000 firefighters are doing battle in the state of California alone. Unmanned aerial vehicles have become a hot topic and could eventually provide help in fighting wildfires. The Desert Research Institute in Nevada is launching a program in conjunction with NASA to develop the use of unmanned aircraft systems called UAS to locate, manage, and fight wildfires. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with the lead researcher at DRI for this project, Adam Watts, who says there is a lot of good use for the unmanned aircraft in fighting wildfires and hopefully save lives in the process.
My great area of interest is using unmanned aircraft systems to observe wildfires so that we can see where they're moving, so that we can protect life and property and increase the safety of firefighters who are combating those wildfires or bushfires. And we can also use instruments that we put on those unmanned aircraft to observe the fire, to sample smoke, and to do some really fantastic research projects by making observations that really haven't been possible before. That's something we're really excited about.
Why weren't they possible? We have fixed-wing aircraft. We have helicopters. You can fly over a wildfire. You can observe things. You can report back to the ground. What is different about using unmanned aircraft systems versus manned regular planes and helicopters?
Well, that's a really good question, and there's been a lot of great work that has been done with manned aircraft and helicopters and really has inspired the kinds of projects that have been done and that we are working on doing with unmanned aircraft. But they do have some advantages, and we're looking to exploit those advantages. For one thing, because they're unmanned, there's no human pilot in the seat, there's no human crew, and so we can go into areas where we already send manned aircraft, but where those missions have a lot of risk. So we can reduce the risk and thereby increase the safety aspect. We can also deploy them in locations such as nighttime flights over fires, where manned aircraft are not prohibited currently to fly over fires in the United States, at least. So that's another area where we can get information that we've not been able to get before.
Tell me about the NASA aspect. Why are they jumping in on this project with DRI?
Well, for one thing, NASA have been leaders in aerospace technology four decades since their formation. And we have the great fortune of close proximity geographically to the NASA Ames Research Center, where, along with NASA Dryden, there has been a lot of leadership in the area of using unmanned aircraft for scientific observations, particularly over wildfires. So we're drawing on their experience and expertise, and we like to think that we also provide some advantages to them as well, because Nevada has been designated one of our six national test sites for unmanned aircraft. So it's really a great collaboration, and we think that's going to provide a lot of good synergy going forward.
Adam Watts, lead researcher at the Desert Research Institute in Reno, Nevada, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Ghosts may conjure up scary ideas, but here's one to think about and maybe not worry about. The practice of ghosting is becoming more prevalent in social and business situations. Some consider it rude, others a considerate way to avoid unpleasantness. Psychiatrist Dr. Nzinga Harrison discussed this issue with International Edition's Susan Yockey.
Ghosting is when someone completely disappears from a relationship with no notice at all. So it comes from kind of like Casper the Ghost. One minute you see him, one minute you don't. And when people leave a relationship, leaving the other person to wonder what in the heck happened, you try to call, you try to text, you try to email, and the other person is literally just dropped off the face of the earth, you've been ghosted.
Now, this can be a personal relationship, but it also sometimes happens in business.
It does, which is incredible to me because the old adage, you know, don't burn your bridges, pretty much flies out the window when you ghost a business relationship. But business relationships, especially when, you know, maybe there's contention over finances, can be as difficult to navigate conflict as personal relationships. And that's really the basis for ghosting, is the ultimate avoidance of conflict.
Is it rude or a considerate way to handle awkward situations?
It's rude. So anyone who says this is a considerate way to handle an awkward situation has never been ghosted. We are a society that really kind of emphasizes this aspect of closure and being able to know what happened and, you know, knowing the role that we played in relationships that ended. And when you ghost someone, whether for business or personal reasons, you really remove the ability for that person to know what happened and leave them in a state of limbo. So it's really a very, very passive, aggressive, hostile, mean thing to do.
Yeah.
In no way is it courteous.
Hurts your feelings. Well, why does this practice, why is it rising in our culture?
You know, I think there are a couple of reasons why it's rising. One that people commonly point to is technology, but from an angle maybe that people don't really consider. So like the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Instagrams, et cetera, I'm too old to know what all of them are these days, really allow us to be connected to more people that are not in our immediate geographic space. And so before, it would be difficult to ghost someone because you would probably run into them at the grocery store, or you would see them at work, or you would see them at church, or you would see them at the football game on Saturday. Now with all of these social media connections where we have relationships over longer distances that really require that we're proactive about seeing people face-to-face, you can ghost from an electronically based relationship and never have to worry about kind of the discomfort of running into that person unplanned.
I'm wondering if all this social media business is making us a little insensitive because we're not having eye-to-eye contact. We're not touching or shaking hands. We're dealing with a machine, after all. And some people deal with the machine all the time and really don't have an interaction with another human or another animal.
I completely agree with you because when you're in a room, right, eye contact actually affects you physiologically, biologically. You get processes through your body, you know, your heart beats, your stomach responds. You can feel the way a person breathes. You're connected through pheromones. And all of that is lost over the technical relationship. All of those things serve to connect us even more and to make it even more difficult to be mean to a person, which is what ghosting is. Ghosting is just being mean.
That was psychiatrist Dr. Nzinga Harrison speaking with my colleague Susan Yockey. Coming up, we'll tell you about drinkable books. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
Waste not, want not. That could be the motto of a shopping center in Brazil that's growing vegetables for its employees on its rooftop by using the waste from the mall at the garden. Besides providing food for employees, the initiative aims to reduce the mall's carbon footprint by reducing the amount of trash that would end up in a garbage dump. About 400 kilos of organic waste are generated every day from the mall's eateries, explains Cicero Evangelista, who is in charge of recycling.
We weigh the material and add enzymes that eliminate bacteria, reduce humidity, and accelerate decomposition. This is how we turn organic waste into organic compost.
In an effort to save as much waste as possible, workshops are held for mall employees so they can learn how to best collect garbage from their stores. Now that's something to feel good about, a project that reuses, reduces, and has social benefits. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you from Washington. The phrase, a thirst for knowledge, may soon take on a new meaning for millions of people around the world who do not have access to clean water. A book that contains specially treated pages that decontaminate water could potentially improve the lives of many in the developing world. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
An estimated 600 to 700 million people around the world are at risk of illness and even death because their drinking water is infected with harmful bacteria and other contaminants. But researcher Terry Dankovich has developed a special book that could turn filthy water into something that's safe to drink. The book contains 25 pages, each about 1 millimeter thick, embedded with nanoparticles of silver. The pages can be used as filters to kill harmful microorganisms, decontaminating polluted drinking water.
And then there's instructions printed on the pages that says water is unsafe to drink in your village, and if you want to protect your health, we use this book to as a water filter, and so some of the symptoms that you can have if you have waterborne disease.
For those who can't read, there are pictures on the pages depicting the dangers of dirty water and how to use the book. The pages are made of filter paper and designed to be ripped from the book so that water can be poured through the paper to be decontaminated. Dankovich will present her invention this week at the meeting of the American Chemical Society in Boston. She and her colleagues field-tested the drinkable book in Bangladesh, Ghana, and South Africa, where it was well-received. Dankovich was asked whether she'd consider printing classic literature on the book's pages.
The idea of classical text, that's interesting, maybe later, but we have discussed a little bit more exciting text, but we haven't really had the time to go through that part.
Dankovich said the text is written with food-safe ink, and each page can filter up to 100 liters of water. The work is being supported by the non-governmental organization Water for Life at a cost to produce of pennies per page. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
There is a new docudrama about the rise and fall of NWA, the music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap. The film is called Straight Outta Compton and chronicles a discontent in Compton, a poor inner-city neighborhood of Los Angeles, wedged between gang violence and police abuse, and how hip-hop music expressed the black community's anger and emotions. VOA's Penelope Palou has more.
Where you think you're going?
Man, I'm just trying to get home.
But that's my son!
You need to get back in the house, or I will ruin your night.
You ain't got to talk to me.
In the tough black neighborhood of Compton, it often seemed like a teenager could not leave his house without getting into some kind of trouble with the police or gangsters.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton docudrama shows how that volatile state of affairs became the seedbed of rap music in the 1980s.
Cruising down the street in my 6-4.
And so NWA, the first rap group, was born.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
The group's tough lyrics on drugs, violence, and poverty, and its visceral music took the world by storm. Filmmaker Gary Gray says he worked hard to keep the story as authentic as possible, actually filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
People are scared of you, Dennis. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
We put it all in the music, all our frustration and anger.
Ice Cube, now a Hollywood mogul, remembers what it was like.
Our music was like our weapon.
And that's the most powerful weapon we got.
His son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays his father as a young man.
They shed light on things that people needed to know.
Speak a little truth and people lose their minds.
But their lyrics prompted harsh public reaction outside of Compton.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
The film focuses on N.W.A.'s rise to fame and follows it through its rifts and final breakup.
Sit tight and let us do our job.
Hey, officer, I'm sorry. What is going
Sir,
on now?
Can you stay right there, please?
But its scenes of police violence are especially hard-hitting after the recent deaths of unarmed black men, such as Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York City at the hands of police.
Well, you're wasting your time, Mr. Manager.
You gotta be kidding me.
You're wasting your time.
Really?
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like. Are you crazy? But that's police harassment.
Straight Outta Compton has attracted positive reviews for offering an authentic portrayal of N.W.A. and for taking us back to a time when daily violence bred a different kind of music. Penelope Bulu, VOA News, Washington.
Yo, Trey.
What up?
I got something to say.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, and video reports on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is gravely concerned about the plight of the Rohingya population in Southeast Asia. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority population of around 1.2 million people living in Burma's Rakhine State, where they are subject to religious-based discrimination and violence and exploitative conditions, including forced labor by the Burma Army, undue restrictions on freedom of movement, and impeded access to medical care and food. They are restricted in marriage and building or maintaining religious buildings. Despite living in Burma for generations, they are made stateless by policies set by previous military regimes. Tens of thousands live in camps for internally displaced persons, with little access to livelihoods, markets, food, or places of worship. They have become increasingly vulnerable to human traffickers, who entice them with promises of a better life abroad. Up to an estimated 500,000 undocumented Rohingya refugees live in neighboring Cox's Bazar district in Bangladesh, and around 32,000 registered Rohingya live in the district's Kutupalong and Nayapata refugee camps, having fled military campaigns and sustained persecution in Rakhine State. The United States has consistently called on the Burmese government to improve the humanitarian situation in Rakhine State by allowing unrestricted humanitarian access to all communities in need and facilitating the voluntary return of all internally displaced Rohingya to their places of origin. President Obama voiced his concerns earlier this summer.
I think if I were Rohingya, I would want to stay where I was born. I'd want to stay in the land where my parents had lived, but I'd want to make sure that my government was protecting me and that people were treating me fairly. That's what I'd want. And that's why it's so important, I think, as part of the democratic transition, to take very seriously this issue of how the Rohingya are treated.
We must all work together to address the conditions in Rakhine State.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.